Jayam Vishnu Paramahamsa Sabharavati Vacharya Asatara Sata Sri Srimad His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nanta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Shiva Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Pranam Shiga Hoshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dwaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shai Mukunda Radha Kunda Gidhi Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navajit Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamaya Juna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharne Nirvasesis and Nivadi Paskachade Satarne. Vandeham Sri Guru Siyuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamshcha. Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shcha Vanchakalpa Chubhascha Kipasin Vyavatapti Tanam Pavanegra Vaishnavi Namah Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
October 16th, 2017, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii on Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature, Text 27. Vaikarika vipurvanan.
Vaikarika vipurvanan.
Manastatvama jayata.
Manastatvama jayata.
Yatsankalpa vikalpa bhyam.
Yatsankalpa vikalpa bhyam.
Vartate kama sambhava.
Vartate kama sambhava.
Vaikarikat.
Vaikarikat.
From the false ego of goodness.
Vikurvanat. Vikurvanat.
Undergoing transformation.
Undergoing transformation.
Manaha.
Manaha.
The mind.
Mind.
Tattvam.
Tattvam.
Principle.
Principle.
Ajayata.
Ajayata.
Evolved.
Evolve.
Yet.
Yet. Yet.
Whose?
Whose?
Sankalpa vikalpa. Oh, sorry. Sankalpa.
Sankalpa.
Thoughts.
Thoughts.
Vikalpabhyam.
Vikalpabhyam.
And by reflections.
And by reflections.
Vartate.
Vartate.
Happens.
Happens.
Kama sambhavaha.
Kama sambhavaha.
The rise of desire. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. From the false ego of goodness, another transformation takes place. From this evolves the mind, whose thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. Purport. The symptoms of the mind are determination and rejection, which are due to different kinds of desires. We desire that which is favorable to our sense gratification, and we reject that which is not favorable to sense gratification. The material mind is not fixed, but the very same mind can be fixed when engaged in the activities of Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, as long as the mind is on the material platform, it is hovering, and all this rejection and acceptance is asat, temporary. It is stated that he whose mind is not fixed in Krishna consciousness must hover between acceptance and rejection. However advanced a man is in academic qualifications, as long as he is not fixed in Krishna consciousness, he will simply accept and reject and will never be able to fix his mind on a particular subject matter. Vaikarikad vikurvanam manas tatvam ajayata yat sankalpa vikalpabhyam vartate kama sambhavaha. From the false ego of goodness, another transformation takes place. From this evolves the mind whose thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. So a fixed mind, to be able to fix our mind, we find that all of the yoga processes have as their intermediate or even in some cases ultimate goal, fixing the mind. And we have all found, I'm sure, that doing that is not a very easy matter. So why is it that we want to fix the mind? What's the point of fixing the mind? And that we can understand by looking at the modes of nature understood in this verse. What happens when the mind is fixed? What happens when the mind is not fixed? And how do we actually fix the mind? So what are the benefits of having the mind fixed, not wandering in this sankalpa and vikalpa? Having it just steady. So the mind is naturally in the mode of goodness. The mind is a creation of the mode of goodness. Of course, goodness is also in false ego. The false ego of goodness is, I am peaceful, I am detached, I am happy, I am free from entanglement in the world. And the reason that those impressions are there is they're actually, to a large extent, true. So what happens in the mode of goodness? Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that one can see things as they are. One knows what is binding, what is liberating, what is to be done, and what is not to be done. Well, that kind of result is something that everyone, not only humans but animals, desires. Everyone wants to know what will give them freedom and what will give them entanglement, and what they should do and what they should not do. And in fact, that's the business of the mind, sankalpa and vikalpa. What should I do? What should I not do? But only in goodness can one see that clearly. In goodness, one has a view of things whereby things are clear. And the example given, it's interesting, Srila Prabhupada gives this example, but it's also given in many yoga traditions, even among the Buddhists, that if you have a pond of water and you stir it up, the mud from the bottom gets distributed in the pond. But if you let it sit, you don't stir it up, then the mud sinks to the bottom. It doesn't disappear, but it sinks to the bottom, the water becomes clear. And then you can see what's in the water. You can see where are the fish, where is the plants, and so forth. And you become, as soon as there's steadiness, there's clarity. And also, in the mode of goodness, one can understand that one is the observer, a point that Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita in the 5th and the 13th chapter, that while it appears that we're doing things in this world, we're not really. We're really the observer. Our quote-unquote doing is simply our expression of desire, but everything is actually done by the modes of nature. We give this example many times. Just like right now, I'm sitting at my computer, I'm having this conversation via my computer. So the things that my computer are doing, I'm not actually doing them. They're being done by the machine. They're being done the person who designed the computer, the electrician, the people who control the flow of information over the internet and so forth, they're actually doing these things. I'm not doing them. I'm not transmitting my voice across the world. But I have a desire. I'm making some effort, some action. I'm doing something. But I'm not really doing what I appear to be doing. That's being done by the machine. So in the mode of goodness, one has an awareness of that. It's not just some theory. It's not just some idea. But it's factually experienced. There's a sense of detachment. And what's very interesting in the mode of goodness with this sense of detachment and being able to know what's to be done and what's not to be done, is that one is no longer under the control of the emotions. So we know the fall down sequence: contemplation, attachment, lust, anger, delusion, bewilderment of memory, and losing intelligence. So generally the mind is overcome by these things, and we experience, in fact, the Bhagavatam says it's like it falls from the sky. You know, when we suddenly get overwhelmed by some sort of emotion or desire, and we just act on it. We just say something, we just do something, without a feeling of choice. You know, anger rises in the body, anger rises in the mind, our body is filled with the chemicals of anger, and then we just respond. And we say, well, it's so hard to control this, because by the time we're aware of it, we're already overwhelmed by it. But in the mode of goodness, one is able to perceive these things at the contemplation stage. One is able to perceive, oh, my mind is contemplating something. Do I want to become attached to this? And you can say, well, no, I don't. Or yes, I do. And if it's something that's harmful, one can use the same sankalpa and vikalpa in the mode of goodness in order to actually control the mind and control the emotions. And I read where a Buddhist was talking about it enlarges your choice point. And I thought, yeah, the way I had always understood it is as if you saw that fall down sequence from a distance. You got some time between contemplation and lust and anger, so that you weren't, or bewilderment of memory, you know, or losing intelligence. So you didn't just find yourself having lost your intelligence and later on saying, how did that happen? Why did I say that? Why did I do that? But you were able to cut it off at a very small point. It's something like the ability to recognize what is a weed and what is a flower as soon as the first true leaves are manifested on the plant. I told this story before. The first time I grew a garden, I just prepared the soil and planted a bunch of marigold and zinnia seeds. But there were tons of weed seeds in that little plot also, and when things started growing, although I had planted my flower seeds equidistant, the whole small area was just covered with green. And I wasn't able to distinguish what's a marigold, what's a zinnia, from what's a weed. I had to wait until the plants were fairly big, so that by the time I wanted to pull the weeds, the roots were a little harder to pull. So a mind that's fixed can recognize weeds in a very beginning state. It actually can recognize the sprouting of the weed beneath the surface of the earth. And a mind in the mode of goodness, a mind that's fixed, also can deal with what Krishna explains, where one should deal with desires the way the ocean deals with rivers. That the rivers go into the ocean, but the ocean is not disturbed by them. The ocean doesn't become greater or lesser because of the movements of the rivers into the ocean. It stays the same. The rivers are coming in, but it doesn't affect the ocean. So a mind in goodness, desires and thoughts enter into the mind, but one doesn't, as it says in the Bible, one doesn't harbor them. I like this word harbor. A harbor is a place where a ship comes in and stays, you know, like a garage. And, you know, in a garage, that's where you keep the car, right? So it's like, don't park your anger, don't park your lust, it stays. What happens in it with the mind is not fixed, is when various thoughts and desires and emotions come through the mind does one of two things, sankalpa and vikalpa. It either grabs them and says, yes, 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 this is good for my sense gratification, this is good for my plans, I accept this emotion, this is me, I accept this desire. Or the mind, vikalpa, the mind rejects it and kicks it away. No, I don't want this. No, I don't want this. But the problem is that both sankalpa and vikalpa are both different signs of attachment. Attachment and aversion, ichha dvesha. So we may think in many spiritual and religious practitioners think, that vikalpa, or rejection of various desires and thoughts of emotion in the mind, is what they're supposed to be doing. But factually, in the mode of goodness, one neither accepts nor rejects. One has this mood of the observer. It's something like you're walking down the street, you're walking in a store, an airport, walking someplace where there's other people. And there's a variety of people who walk past you. Some of them are very physically attractive. Some of them are physically unattractive. Some of them would be people that you might feel you want to know. Some of them are people that you would definitely not want to know. But you're simply walking past them. You're neither accepting nor rejecting any of those people. They're simply going through. They come into your line of vision. They come into some physical proximity, and then they leave it. And that is what happens in the mode of goodness. The thoughts and the desires and the emotions of this world, they come and we acknowledge them. We don't reject them. One may say, as a disinterested, one could say even amused observer, oh, there's an emotion of confusion. There's an emotion of anger. There's a feeling of sexual lust. There's whatever it may be. And the mind says, oh, that's interesting. How interesting is this body and this mind? And those thoughts and desires and emotions, they're not given a harbor. They're not given a garage. They're not given a parking space. Nor are they exploded. nor does one get out the weapons to fight them. So we were just reading in the fourth canto in our morning program here that liberation is not attained by fighting the obstacles offered by Maya. So one doesn't fight them either. You know, if there's a ship coming in and you decide, is this a friendly ship? So then you give it a harbor. Or is it an enemy ship? And then you get out your, missiles to shoot the ship. Either way, you're absorbed in the ship. So a fixed mind in the mode of goodness is not absorbed in the things of the world. But it has this detachment. And this detachment and the sense of the observer and this being able to discriminate what I should accept and what I should not accept, what is binding and what is liberating, gives rise to a great feeling of joy. If there is any happiness in material life, it happens at this platform of the mode of goodness. So it gives rise to a feeling of joy. And the joy is not unlimited joy, like on the spiritual platform, but it's something that's very tangible. And a feeling of peace and a feeling of freedom. Huh? So Krishna says something very interesting about this feeling of happiness and peace and freedom that happen in the mode of goodness. He says that this feeling of happiness awakens one to self-realization. So the kind of happiness one experiences when the mind is in its natural position of the mode of goodness easily awakens one to self-realization. I remember Jayapataka Maharaj one time comparing it to an airport from which you can take an airplane. So the airport, you just go to the airport. That doesn't mean that you are on the airplane, but that's the place from which you can very easily get on the airplane. I mean, with bhakti, it's possible to go to self-realization even from passion and ignorance directly, like Magrari and Jagai and Madai and so forth. But when one has one's mind in the mode of goodness, very easily self-realization can awaken. Of course, as an aside at this point, there's also a problem to having the mind in the mode of goodness, and that is that one can be conditioned by that sense of happiness and not want to go further. One can say, oh, okay, now I'm happy, I'm peaceful, I'm above the fray of the world, and I don't need to go any further. And so sometimes we find that trying to teach Krishna consciousness to people in the mode of goodness is very difficult because they appreciate what we're doing, they're willing to take part in what we're doing, but they don't feel that they really need it. So what happens when the mind gets into passion and ignorance, which is unfortunately seems to be the default state at this point in time and place in Kali Yuga? The way that mind is created, as explained here in other places in the Bhagavatam, is in goodness. Goodness is, we could say, the factory state, the default value of the mind. But the mind very quickly can get involved in passion and ignorance. You can think of, because the mind is in fact a machine, you can think of passion, ignorance as like some kind of malware, some kind of virus that infects the natural programming of the mind. So when the mind becomes in passion, ignorance, it becomes, as Prabhupada says in his lecture on this verse, given in Bombay, it becomes like a hurricane. And I thought that was a very appropriate simile, considering that in the past weeks we've had a number of major hurricanes. So there was a hurricane that hit Texas, one that hit Florida and the Caribbean islands. Some of the Caribbean islands are just decimated. Barbuda is just, it's finished. All the human inhabitants had to leave Barbuda. They said it's just uninhabitable. And as we're having this class, amazingly, there's a hurricane aimed at Northern Ireland and Great Britain. Now, who ever thinks of a major hurricane? It may become what they call an extropical storm. But who ever thinks of a hurricane in that part of the world? So these hurricanes are unstoppable. You know, when the weather service says there's a hurricane coming, nobody says, well, let's see if we can stop it. You just try to get out of the way and try to limit the damage from it. Chanchali Himanat Krishna, Arjuna said, I can't. And he even said this 5,000 years ago. He said, my mind is like a hurricane. So this is a mind, I mean, obviously this doesn't actually apply to Arjuna, but this is a mind that's beset by passion and ignorance. And passion and ignorance, as soon as one has the goal of sense gratification, which in passion is pious sense gratification, karma, and ignorance is impious sense gratification, vikarma, then one actively wants to either harbor boats or shoot at them. That's one's goal. These boats of emotions and desires are the means by which somebody induced by passion and ignorance is hoping to find satisfaction. You know, here's the good food boat, and here's the nice person boat, and here's the money boat, and here's... And so the person in passionate ignorance, their whole intention is to make a connection between their senses and the sense objects. That's what they're living for. And therefore, they're evaluating each sense object. Will this bring me satisfaction when it's connected? You know, it's like, does this boat have a cargo load from which I'm going to be able to make a profit? That's how they're looking at it. And so their person in the mode of passion ignorance is thinking, oh, this is a boat I want to harbor. And if they're feeling it's not going to satisfy me, it's not my particular desires, then they get out some sort of missile and they shoot at it. And the result is that these emotions and desires overwhelm the mind. And one is then buffeted about by the modes of nature. Just like in a hurricane. Just like a hurricane comes through and it saturates the ground and it blows the trees and the trees in the super wet ground, even they may be, 3 and 4 feet in diameter, they fall over. I mean, I saw this myself years ago when I was in Hurricane Fran. It's humongous trees. They just become uprooted. You know, after the storm, you go around and there's these unbelievable, just these huge root systems that are sticking out of the ground. And this is what happens when the mind is pulled by these sankalpas and vikalpas. And Prabhupada, in his lecture on this verse, he says what we're doing in the modes of passion ignorance particularly is we start making unlimited plans. We think, well, okay, all right, let me get the right boat in and the right boat out. And this, of course, translates into not just with sense objects, but with people. Everything becomes friend and enemy. We were, again, just reading in the story of Dhruva Maharaj how he lamented seeing his stepbrother as an enemy. I guess his half-brother. Seeing his half-brother as an enemy. So why did I see him as an enemy? Why did I see my stepmother as an enemy? But we think in terms of enemies and friends. Again, this is a person who pleases my senses and mind. This is a person who doesn't. And this is, it's all illusion. It's just illusion. Because we're not this body, we're not this mind, we're not part of this world. And therefore, these unlimited plans and this accepting and rejecting of our various objects, we don't become happy. And this is true whether it's on an individual level, a family level, a community level, a national level, so many plans. And in fact, Prahlad Maharaj says that our plans often have an opposite result. So I give the example many times of something that I studied when I was in graduate school as far as unintended consequences. How the United States has been working to give equal opportunity to both normally abled and disabled people. So in that mood, they passed a law requiring that doctors have sign interpreters for deaf people. Well, the problem is that healthcare is not government-funded in America. Healthcare is funded by individuals or the individual insurance companies, and evidently having sign interpreters is a very expensive procedure. So if a doctor was going to see a deaf or hearing impaired person, they had to pay a lot of extra money for the interpreter, but that was money that they could not pass on to the patient. And of course, it's extremely easy to tell when a person makes a medical appointment if they're hearing impaired, I guess unless they have someone else make the appointment for them. And therefore, basically, the receptionists and so forth were just simply not giving appointments to hearing impaired people. So rather than the hearing impaired people getting better medical care, they got no medical care. Something which has just recently happened is the Supreme Court of India has just decided that if a husband has sexual intercourse with his wife, but the wife is under the age of 18, that such marital relations will be counted as rape. So, of course, we have in America and in most of the world something called statutory rape, where if a person who's a legal adult has sexual relations with someone under the age of consent, even if it was a consensual relationship, because they're under the age of consent, it's considered that even though they consented, they actually weren't old enough to consent. So it's called statutory rape. And such people are put on the criminal registry. There was an interesting case in America where I think the young man was like 18 or 19. He had relations with a 14-year-old girl. She became pregnant, and he married her. When the child was delivered, the hospital noticed that the delivery date and their wedding date were such that the child must have been conceived before their wedding, and therefore they reported the husband to the legal authorities as engaging in statutory rape, for which he was imprisoned and he was put on the registry as sex offenders. Now, of course, let's say that he hadn't married her. Let's say that he hadn't married her, hadn't been put on the birth certificate. He'd been irresponsible. Then he wouldn't have been charged unless she charged him. Or let's say that he told her to have an abortion. Then he wouldn't have been charged with the crime. So because he did the honorable thing of marrying her, therefore he was charged with the crime. And a similar thing, I would predict, is going to happen with this new law in India. So you have, they estimate, 23 million women who are married but under 18. The previous law was if the woman was between 15 and 18 but married, their relations with the husband were not considered rape. So let's say you're a 16-year-old or 17-year-old bride. You're pregnant by your husband, who's 19 or 20, and you want to go to an official medical center to give birth. So as soon as you do that, your husband's going to be charged with rape. And I thought that this law is simply going to induce women not to get prenatal care and not to go to an authorized, you know, to have some actual medical person deliver their baby. It's so what they're thinking is, oh, we're going to help these women. We're going to protect women from forced child marriages, and you know that's a laudable idea, but the consequences will be different. And also we find these laws don't do anything to stop just consensual illicit relationships under the age of 18. So it's almost like they're assuming that all women under the age of 18 are going to remain celibate, which of course is not the case in modern society. So these are just some very simple examples of where people with good intentions, they make a plan to become happy in this world. I mean, these are examples on the scale of governments, but we can see these examples in our own life. You know, we make a plan to be happy. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. and the plan looks really good. You know, this is a great plan. We're going to provide sign language interpreters for deaf patients. You know, we're not going to allow women under 18 to have relations with their husband. You know, that way people won't marry women under 18 is what they're thinking. So, you know, this is such a great plan. But the actual result ends up being different. The actual result ends up that people are harmed. And these sort of plans, so then we make a new plan. We say, oh, okay, well now we'll do this plan. And that plan also doesn't work out. Oh, now we'll do this plan. And it goes on perpetually, making plans, trying to become happy. But as long as we make plans with a mind infected by passion and ignorance, the definition of a mind in passion and ignorance is that we do not know what's to be done and what's not to be done. In passion, sometimes we get it right, and sometimes we get it wrong. In ignorance, we basically always get it wrong. We're always going in the wrong direction. You know, we think that serving cow meat to starving people is helpful. You know, we just have it completely backwards. So how are we going to do a return to the mode of goodness? And of course, if we try to look at this from the point of view of those of us wanting to be Krishna conscious, a mind that's in the mode of passion ignorance is a big problem for us. You know, we go to Mangalartik and we're chanting the mantras with our mouth, but our mind may be doing this passion ignorance plan making. What am I going to do today? I have to do that. And we sit to chant japa, and you know, we go through 16 rounds and we haven't heard one name of one mantra. And it's, or we find ourselves being overcome by anger or lust or illusion, even though we're doing our best to practice Krishna consciousness. So this problem affects those, not only just, you know, those gross hogs, dogs, camels, and asses of materialists, but it affects even people striving for spiritual life. As Krishna says, you know, any sense object on which the mind fixates will pull away the mind even of a learned person who is trying to control it. Now, I'm sure we've all had this experience. So we have this malware, this virus of passion ignorance that's disturbing the mind, and how do we return, how do we do a factory reset to the mode of goodness where the mind becomes fixed, and in the mode of goodness we have a kind of happiness that awakens us to self-realization. We should also note that Krishna tells Uddhava that if you can't fully be in bhakti immediately, at least you should be in the mode of goodness. So where's this factory reset button? So all the forms of yoga, whether karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, or bhakti yoga, all have as an intermediate or even ultimate goal to put the mind in the mode of goodness. So karma yoga tries to do this through karma palatyaga, through giving up the fruits of your work. You work as if an attached person were, according to Varnashram, but then the results of your work you dedicate for a higher purpose. Now, if you're not going to try to enjoy the fruits of your work, you gradually become detached from them, and you gradually enter into the state of goodness and peace. Of course, that's a very difficult thing to do, because why work if you're not going to enjoy the fruits? Detached work is very difficult. Working just for the sake of salvation. And karma yoga is particularly difficult in this age, because to do karma yoga, you first have to know how to do karma. And just very frankly, most people don't know how to do karma. Karma means varnashram. So you find very few people who are proper Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, or Brahmacharis, Grahasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis. You know, I would venture to say that even very, very few people practicing Krishna consciousness at the present moment could say they're perfectly situated in a varna and an ashram. And you have to be perfectly situated in a varna or an ashram in order to then use that varna and ashram for karma yoga. So jnana yoga is you try to get the mind in the mode of goodness through philosophical discussion, which puts you in a state of detachment that you just think about and meditate on and talk about how the world is a world of suffering, how we're not this body and so forth. And eventually, by discussing these things enough, one jumps over the border to realization of them. Of course, this is also very difficult. Most people find it hard to listen to philosophy for much more than a half an hour. You know, they'll start pulling out their phones and playing Scrabble or something, and then they don't remember it. you know, we'll sit down and read Prabhupada's books, we sit down and have a philosophical discussion, and 5 minutes later, half an hour later, we can't remember what we read. So we have a very hard time doing Gyan Yoga, and also it's a difficult process because, like Karma Yoga, you don't have the material pleasure. You give up the material pleasure, but you don't yet have the spiritual pleasure. Therefore, Krishna says it's poison in the beginning. So what about Gyan Yoga? Prabhupada, in his lecture on this verse, speaks particularly about Gyan Yoga or meditative yoga, Astanga Yoga. So in Astanga Yoga, they try to fix the mind, get the mind back into the default factory reset of the mode of goodness by working directly at fixing the mind. And they do this by first doing Yam and Niyam, which basically is in the category of karma or perhaps karma yoga. And then they do mechanical things with the body that really help to fix the mind. The mind is, after all, a machine. So Gyan Yoga does the factory reset very literally by looking for the factory reset button on the device. And as you know, when you have devices with a factory reset button, the button is usually not so easy to access. It's usually somewhat recessed in the device, and you have to get some kind of tool to access it. So similarly with the mind, which is a machine, in order to do the factory reset, you have to get certain tools. So it turns out that if you physically put the bones and muscles of the body in certain postures, and if you breathe in a particular way, then you access that factory recess button. It's, again, kind of like, you know, or on your phone. If you want to, like my phone has a little case on it, and if I want to take out the SIM card or the SD card, so I have to remove the case, and then there's this little recess hole, and I have to poke a special tool or a paper clip in there, and it pops out a drawer and so forth. So the asanas and the pranayam, they do that. They make it available. They put the mind in a state where you can do this reset. And then what you have to do? Then you have to withdraw your senses from the external world, pratyahara. And then after doing that, you mechanically fix your mind on one thing, whether it's, you know, traditionally you would fix your mind on a mantra and on the form of the Lord. Nowadays people fix their mind on a candle or on their breath. But if you fix your mind, frankly, on anything, the mind becomes fixed. Of course, again, this is also difficult. Klesha dikatarashate sham. This is very difficult. First of all, most people don't even want to learn the yoga asanas and the pranayam. That takes some time to learn them and to practice them. You know, people have a hard enough time just getting 30 minutes of gross exercise 3 times a week, and to get people to do that and then to withdraw from the world. They don't want to withdraw from the world. They want to be involved in the world and so forth. So it's extremely difficult. And it may take a long time. You know, it may take 20 years before you can fix your mind for 2 hours. And again, you have the same situation with all three, Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga, that it's poison at the beginning and nectar at the end. You're giving up, you're having to give up the so-called enjoyment of the material senses, but you don't yet have spiritual enjoyment. You have this period in between where you have neither material nor spiritual enjoyment. Well, and this was one of Arjuna's questions in the Gyan Yoga chapter, chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, you know, it seems to me that I will have nothing. So what do we do in Bhakti Yoga? Bhakti Yoga is Kevala Nandakanda. Bhakti Yoga is not poison at the beginning and nectar at the end. It's not like that. It actually can be nectarian right through, although it is a fact that until the mind becomes fixed, there will be a hard struggle with determination. That's a fact. It will require willpower. There will be a struggle. There's no question about it. But it will be a happy struggle with determination. It will not be dry. It should not be dry. If our hard struggle with determination until nishtha is dry, then we're probably not doing bhakti yoga. Then we're probably doing more karma yoga, gyan yoga, or jnan yoga. Or we're doing some kind of mix where the other yogas are predominating. As soon as bhakti yoga predominates, then the entire process is a happy process. Even though in anistha sadhana bhakti it's a struggle, and at nishtha sadhana bhakti it's coming more or less automatically. And so Prabhupada in this lecture, it was really interesting when I was listening to the lecture on this verse, I realized, oh, This is where I grabbed the audio for my presentation on dealing with sexual desire, where Prabhupada says, kama, this lust, use it to make plans for Krishna. What's done in the mode of passion and ignorance to make plans for enjoying the world, use that tendency to make plans for Krishna. Those in Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, Dhyan Yoga, they try to stop all plan making. But those of us in Bhakti, especially in Mahaprabhu's movement, which is a preaching movement, we can fill our mind with making plans to spread Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada also really emphasizes in his lecture that we can only do this under the instruction of a guru. And such is the case for all of the kinds of yoga. One will not be able, you know, it's just, again, you have a machine and you want to know how to do a factory reset. You have to look at the instruction manual. I mean, you could try just like poking it here and there, you know. You might just break it. You've got to look at the instruction manual. Or you've got to call some representative of the company. And they walk you through the steps. So you have to do this, you have to do this. So we have to find somebody who already has a fixed mind. We have to find somebody, actually, we Vaishnavas, we're trying to find someone who has beyond a fixed mind. We want to find somebody who's already at the Vaishnava platform. And Prabhupada talks about what are the qualifications for finding such a guide. Samyak prani strotriyam brahma nistam. So people often ask, how can I tell who's a guru? So samyak prani, so someone who's engaged in menial service to their own guru, strotriyam, who has heard. Now the word heard implies that they've heard from a bona fide disciplic succession, that they're not a self-made guru. No, they didn't just say, I've had my own realization. But they've actually, it's something that they've heard. And they've heard through menial service. Brahma nishtam means that they are themselves Brahma in spirit, fixed. Nishta, they are fixed in spirit. So their mind is not only fixed in the mode of goodness, but they've made that leap from the airport to the airplane. And they're actually in transcendence. And to become, have our mind fixed in Krishna in this way, although it still requires some willpower and struggle until one becomes fixed. It does. Although it doesn't come automatically in the beginning. It is the most natural way to restore our mind to its original place and to go from there to spirituality. First of all, it doesn't require two processes. It doesn't require a process to fix the mind and then a process to go from there to self-realization. It's aiming at self-realization from the beginning. So it doesn't have this intermediate, dry process. Also, Krishna is a person, and he's an all-attractive person. He's a person full of pleasure. And therefore, thinking about him and his pastimes and his form and his name and his mission is exactly the kind of thing that we tend to do in the world anyway. We generally fill our mind and our thoughts and our plans with people and places and events and activities which are attractive. We have a natural tendency to hear about others and to think about others. Right? It was really funny. My grandsons and I were doing some work in the house yesterday, and one of my grandsons was wearing a ring, and so we were doing a video chat with his mother, with their mother, about like what book she wanted us to ship to her. And she asked him, what's that ring? And he says, oh, it's a Lord of the Rings ring. And then one of his brothers says something I couldn't understand. I said, what is that? He said, oh, that's the encryption that's on the ring. And, you know, and I said, so you've memorized something in a made-up language that's on a, you know, a fictional ring, and you memorize that? And he says, yeah, I memorized the whole poem. Like, you know, this is our natural inclination. Our natural inclination is to hear about someone or something wonderful and to think about it and to plan for it. It's natural that we do. It's what we're doing anyway. So even if we're in the mode of passion ignorance, we just take that tendency and use it to hear about Krishna. And then our mind becomes fixed. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And one of my friends recommended to me a book written by this Buddhist about meditation. Very, very famous person. I mean, he's met with most of the world leaders, and he's teaching meditation in businesses and etc. all over the world. But he's teaching a voidist kind of meditation. Anyway, he was describing the results of his meditation, and he was very clear that what he was describing was in the mode of goodness. He was using, of course, a lot of the typical Vedic Sanskrit terminology. And it was kind of a shock for me to realize, wow, these things naturally have happened to me without my aiming for them separately. I was just kind of astonished. And I thought, here this person is making this huge endeavor, this very difficult artificial endeavor. I'm going to sit down for 2 hours a day and just fix my mind on my breath, and to achieve basically the mode of goodness for the mind. And just by engaging in the Sankirtan movement under the direction of a great Vaishnava such as Srila Prabhupada, that those things naturally come. You know, they're there as side benefits. One hardly even recognizes them. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this morning, I was talking about Bill Mangala Thakur, and he was saying how he has this verse that liberation is just waiting to serve me with folded hands. I mean, putting the mind in the mode of goodness isn't even liberation. It's a springboard for liberation. But for the great devotees who meditate on Krishna, even liberation is a side effect. So this is a process we can all do. Whether we're educated, whether we're not educated, whether we're physically abled or physically disabled, whether we're male, whether we're female, how much brown is in our skin, how curly our hair is, you know, whether we've been a perfect celibate or been married 50 times or whatever, we can fix our mind on Krishna and plans to spread Krishna consciousness. When our mind starts going in the sankalpa vikalpa for the material world, we can have our sankalpa: how am I going to please my spiritual master and his mission? How am I going to spread Mahaprabhu's mission? And there is enough to do that we couldn't complete it in 100 lifetimes. There are enough stories to hear, enough pastimes to hear of the Lord and his devotees to think about. There's enough work to do for the mission. There's enough plans to do for the mission. There's enough worship to do for the deities. There's enough preparation to cook for the deities and to distribute to the public. There's enough books to distribute. There's enough books to translate. There's enough books we can write. There's enough to do that our minds can be completely absorbed. And then we'll find, without separate endeavor, that all of a sudden we realize my mind's becoming fixed. I'm experiencing myself as the observer. I'm no longer either harboring the ships of emotions and desires, nor am I trying to shoot at them. Yoginam api sarvesham magitan antarakna shadavam bhajate yomam samayuktatvam. Questions, comments, additions, subtractions? I have 5 minutes.
Muted. Unmuted.
Okay, if a person in the mode of passion or ignorance has a propensity to practice karma yoga or Brahman realization but not bhakti, is it okay? This is a question we have here. All of the four kinds of yoga or mixtures of them are all bona fide processes. They're given by Krishna, they're in the Shastra, they are all bona fide processes. Karma yoga, Jnana yoga, Dhyana yoga, Bhakti yoga, and any mixture of these are all bona fide processes. Without some mixture of bhakti into these other yogas, they will not be very effective. Ultimately, they will not be effective. one has to have some admixture of bhakti in them. But we can say that only bhakti yoga is recommended in Kali Yuga. And at any time and at any place, it is the easiest and most natural form of yoga. So even in other ages, when people were more qualified to practice the other yogas, bhakti yoga is still the most recommended. At the present time, it's particularly recommended because a person may be inclined to the other forms of yoga, but they probably aren't going to be able to be very good at them.
I find it, I've talked a lot, I don't know, about resetting back to the default, or what should be the default, the mode of goodness. I guess the real default is the mode of pure goodness.
Well, not for the mind. The mind is a material machine, as explained here, that actually was created by it from the mode of goodness. Mm. So the natural default setting for the mind is the mode of goodness. Now, you could say the whole mind and body is originally spirit, so you could make that point also.
I guess where I was going was that it's because of the influence of the age of Kali, the much more accessible, which seemed to be sort of winning in the competition between the modes of nature, are ignorance and passion. And I find it difficult. The only time I find that the mode of goodness is easier to access is like early in the morning during the Brahma Muhurta. It's kind of a lot easier to keep the mind in the mode of goodness. That's why we get up early and chant. That's why we hear Bhagavatam early. But then later in the day, it seems that the mode of passion really kicks in. And so I don't feel a lot of access to goodness, but perhaps more access to pure goodness. And then if I'm engaging in devotional activities passionately, trying to do things, get things done, dealing with problems at the temple, et cetera, et cetera.
But that's not really the mode of passion. You know, one is taking advantage of the fact that during the bulk of the day, when the sun is active, that the mode of passion is in the atmosphere, and then it's easier to express bhakti through active things, physically and mentally active things.
That's exactly my point.
Right.
And then
that doesn't mean that you're in the mode of passion.
Right.
It just means that you're working with the situation that's around you. But the fact is that if you do that in pure goodness, in Krishna consciousness, you will find that your mind is in goodness, even though apparently you're doing things that appear to be passionate. Your mind will not become influenced by the mode of passion. The mind will remain in goodness. And ultimately, when you come to bhakti, the subtle body is dissolved. It's just dissolved, and your consciousness is totally in transcendence.
Nice.
The mind in the mode of goodness is, as I say, it's a springboard. It's not our ultimate thing, but yeah, one is apparently acting in passion, or even in ignorance. We're sleeping. Sleeping isn't ignorant. So when the mode of ignorance is dominant, then we sleep. But that doesn't mean that we're actually influenced by the mode of ignorance. You're just using a machine the way it's intended to be used. That doesn't mean that you're influenced by the machine or you're identifying with the machine.
Maybe we could say we're influenced by the modes of, say, passion in the afternoon and ignorance in the evening for sleep, but we're not contaminated by them.
I would say that we don't even have to be influenced by them.
That's a pretty elevated stage.
No, I don't think so. I actually don't think so. Hmm. I think if we're absorbed in trying to please Guru and Krishna, then we're simply working with the way the machine around us is working, but it doesn't touch us within at all.
Mm.
It's seeing in action in action. And here's the question: intelligence seems like it should be. That's a typical question. It seems like mind should be in passion, and intelligence should be in goodness. That's just because we're experiencing the mind in passion and ignorance. The natural state of the mind is in goodness. When the mind is in goodness, it becomes really happy. It's like, oh, I'm home. But intelligence particularly is involved in... it's Pasyanti Bhak, the voice of Pasyanti Bhak. Intelligence is particularly involved in plan making. The mind is actually not in its natural state. All right, we have our morning program here, so I have to go. I'm sorry. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.